What if I told you that driving your car just 2 miles down the street to the grocery store is actually destroying its engine way faster than like a 100-mile daily highway commute?
I mean, it sounds completely backwards, doesn't it? We're so conditioned to believe that low mileage automatically equals less wear and tear.
Right. Lower is always better.
Exactly. But when you look at the actual physics of how modern combustion engines work, those short trips are just incredibly punishing.
Well, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are pulling back the plastic covers on really modern mechanical complexity.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic.
It totally is. And we're looking at this incredibly comprehensive, hot-off-the-press diagnostic guide. It was literally published today, June 12, 2026.
Hot press.
Yeah, it comes from Autoscope, which is this independent European auto shop that's been operating down in Dallas and Plano since, I think, 1982.
That's right. Now, on the surface, the data we're examining is a repair guide specifically for the BMW 520i.
But our mission for you today is much bigger than just diagnosing one specific German sedan.
Totally. We are basically using the 520i as our masterclass.
Exactly. We're going to use this specific car's mechanical quirks to really help you understand the broader landscape of modern automotive engineering.
Because it applies to almost everything on the road now.
Right. We'll explore the absolute domino effect of deferred maintenance, how environmental factors quietly destroy your hardware, and, how you can just be a smarter owner of whatever advanced machine is sitting in your garage right now.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the very first trap that people fall into is treating all cars with the exact same badge on the trunk as if they're identical pieces of machinery.
Oh, absolutely. And you really cannot properly diagnose any complex system until you know exactly which version of the system you're actually looking at.
Right.
With the 528i, the name itself is essentially, well, it's a misnomer. It covers two entirely different generations of engineering.
Right. There is a massive identity crisis between these models. Like, on one side, you have the older models, the E60 generation, and the 2011 F10 generation. Yeah, those use a 3.0-liter naturally aspirated inline six engine.
But then, from 2012 to 2016, they completely swapped the architecture for a 2.0-liter turbocharged four-cylinder.
And see, understanding that distinction fundamentally changes your entire maintenance strategy.
I bet.
The older inline six is really highly valued for this incredibly smooth power delivery. It's a simply non-turbocharged layout.
So the focus is different.
Right, so when you're maintaining it, your focus is primarily on just basic age-related wear and tear. You're looking at things like the VANOS system.
Wait, the VANOS system, let's actually pause on that for a second. That's the variable valve timing network, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It adjusts when the valves open and close to optimize performance, but it relies heavily on oil pressure to make those precise mechanical adjustments, doesn't it?
Spot on. It uses the engine oil pressure to physically actuate these camshaft gears. So if your oil is old and degraded, or if the tiny internal seals inside that VANOS unit get tired.
And start bleeding off pressure.
Exactly. The mechanical timing gets sloppy, the engine loses power, it idles poorly, and your efficiency just drops. It's the perfect example of age and fluid-related degradation.
Okay, makes sense. But then you compare that to the 2012 to 2016 model with the Turbo 4. I mean, that engine offers immense low-end torque, better fuel efficiency, but that requires a staggering amount of added complexity.
A massive amount.
Suddenly, your repair focus shifts completely away from basic age-related seals and heavily toward, like, the internal timing chain, the stressed turbo systems, and the direct injection.
What's fascinating here is that the direct injection is a critical distinction.
How so?
While in older port-injected engines, the fuel is sprayed into the intake manifold, which means the gasoline physically washes over the intake valves, right?
Right, it acts like a cleaner.
Exactly, keeping them clean. But with direct injection, the fuel is sprayed directly into the combustion cylinder under immense pressure.
Which means the intake valves stay completely dry.
Precisely. They stay entirely dry. So when microscopic oil vapors from the engine's crankcase ventilation system circulate back into the
Which
intake,
is like a totally normal process,
right,
right?
totally normal. But that oil bakes onto those hot, dry intake valves. Over time, this creates massive carbon buildup that literally chokes the engine of oxygen.
Wow.
The car begins to misfire and stutter, not because a part actually broke, but because the airflow is physically obstructed.
That's crazy. It's like Assuming every 528i is the same is like buying a house based purely on the street address.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Yeah, you assume it's a house, but you haven't checked if you're walking into a 100-year-old Victorian with knob and tube electrical wiring or, you know, a brand new smart home with a solar roof and a battery wall.
Right, and if you hire a contractor without knowing which underlying architecture you're dealing with, you are going to waste a tremendous amount of money. Because that underlying architecture dictates the vulnerability. If an inline six has a rough idle, the historical context tells a technician to look at those age-related vacuum leaks or tired spark plugs or that vano seal wear.
Right.
But if a Turbo 4 has a rough idle, especially accompanied by a scraping noise, the context immediately points toward the internal timing chains stretching or breaking down.
But I got to push back on this a bit. Modern vehicles are these incredibly advanced computing networks, right?
Sure.
If the car has a computer, and that computer throws a code telling the mechanic exactly what's failing, why does the underlying engine type even matter? Shouldn't the computer just say, hey, my internal timing chain is failing, or my intake valves are choked with carbon?
I mean, you would think so, but because the computer doesn't actually possess mechanical vision,
it can't see the chain.
Right. It only perceives symptoms based on electrical data. The computer only knows that the air-to-fuel ratio is statistically wrong, or an oxygen sensor is reading out of bounds.
Okay, so it just sees the math is off.
Exactly. So a rough idle code could be worn spark plugs, sure, but it could equally be failing ignition coils, a hidden vacuum leak, jammed mano solenoids, software fuel trim problems, or just a single failing sensor giving the computer bad math.
Wow. So if you don't know the engine's inherent weaknesses, you might blindly replace all the coils and spark plugs, spend a fortune, only to find out you had a tiny crack in an intake hose the entire time.
Happens all the time. And mistaking the engine type is really just the first trap. Once you know what machine you have, you realize none of these vulnerabilities exist in isolation.
A failing part doesn't just quietly break. It takes other systems down with it.
It's a complete chain reaction.
Let's look at oil leaks for a second. Specifically, the oil filter housing gasket.
Yeah, it's vital to understand why an oil leak today is not just a matter of leaving an annoying, messy spot on your driveway.
Right, it's much worse.
The physical reality of an oil leak in a tightly packed, heavily shielded modern engine bay is that the oil migrates. It travels along the engine block.
And gravity pulls that migrating oil straight down, right onto your critical rubber components. It coats your drive belts, your coolant hoses, and these complex plastic housings.
It physically contaminates them.
And here we really have to factor in the specific environment, right?
Yeah.
Because Autoscope is in Dallas and Plano. Operating a vehicle there means dealing with severe, sustained summer heat.
Brutal heat.
That ambient temperature, combined with the operating heat of the engine, rapidly bakes these rubber and plastic gaskets.
Yeah, it's the relentless heat cycling that really does the damage. You have an engine getting incredibly hot, expanding the metal and the rubber seals, and then cooling down and contracting day after day after day.
Like a rubber band left in the sun.
Exactly. Eventually, the rubber loses its plasticizers. It turns from a flexible, watertight seal into hard, brittle plastic that just cracks under pressure.
So a brittle gasket cracks, and oil slowly drops onto a rubber serpentine drive belt.
Yep. And engine oil chemically degrades the specific rubber used in drive belts. The belt absorbs the oil, it swells, softens, and loses its structural integrity.
Oh, man.
Suddenly, you're doing 70 miles an hour on the Dallas North Poleway, and that degraded belt just snaps. In an instant, you lose your alternator, your power steering, and your water pump.
That's terrifying. So a $20 rubber gasket that was ignored just caused thousands of dollars in secondary catastrophic damage.
Exactly.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, like, a tiny, almost imperceptible leak in a deep-sea submarine.
Okay, I can see that.
If you're sitting on the surface, a small drip from a valve isn't a massive issue. You just wipe it up. But when you are fully submerged at crushed depth, under immense physical pressure, that tiny leak is a system killer. The pressure turns that drip into a violent spray that shorts out critical electronics and dooms the whole vessel.
That is a brilliant comparison. Modern car cooling systems operate very much like that submarine.
Right.
They operate under extreme sealed pressure to raise the boiling point of the coolant fluid. Many of these 528i models utilize these highly complex electronically controlled water pumps and intricate plastic coolant fittings.
Plastic fittings under high pressure.
Yeah, and when you have a system under that much pressure, a microscopic, almost invisible leak can turn into a catastrophic failure extremely quickly, especially during a hot stop-and-go summer commute.
And the first sign of trouble often isn't, you know, a massive Hollywood-style cloud of steam or a huge puddle of green coolant.
Rarely.
It might just be an intermittent warning light, a slight loss of coolant over a month, or even just weak, lukewarm heat coming from the vents in the winter.
Right. And repeatedly topping off your coolant reservoir without actually finding the root cause of the pressure leak is an incredibly risky gamble.
It's a fatal error for the structural integrity of the engine block, isn't it?
Absolutely. Because if you are physically losing coolant, the closed system has lost its ability to hold pressure.
And pressure is what keeps it from boiling.
Exactly. When the system loses pressure, the boiling point of the liquid drops dramatically. The coolant will literally flash boil into steam inside the internal jackets of the engine block.
And steam doesn't transfer heat away from metal.
Not at all. Steam pockets create localized hotspots. The metal temperatures spike exponentially, and the aluminum engine block or the cylinder head physically warps from the thermal stress.
So just by topping off the fluid and ignoring the microscopic leak, you're essentially guaranteeing an overheating event that completely destroys the motor.
You're sealing its fate.
We also have to look at the mechanical domino effect involving the timing chain, right? Specifically for those turbocharged four-cylinder models.
Yeah, that's a big one.
The timing chain is buried deep inside the engine, keeping the rotation of the bottom half perfectly synchronized with the valves in the top half.
Crucial component.
If you hear a high-pitched whining or a scraping noise from the front of the engine, or if the computer throws a generic drivetrain malfunction warning, the correct approach is definitely not a panic replacement of the chain.
No, absolutely not. Because those timing components are completely internal, you cannot just guess based on an acoustic noise. It requires an incredibly careful review of the physical symptoms. A technician needs to drain the oil and inspect the filter. Are there microscopic metal shavings? Are there bits of brittle plastic from the chain guides trapped in the filter media?
Oh, looking for actual debris.
Exactly. Are there specific camshaft timing faults registered deep in the engine computer? You have to evaluate the hard mechanical evidence before you tear the entire front of an engine apart.
Makes total sense. So we have these highly physical, tangible, mechanical dominoes, right? Mm-hmm. Oil leaks, degrading rubber belts, micro leaks, dropping pressure, and warping metal.
The physical stuff.
Right. But modern vehicles also possess an invisible digital nervous system that is just as fragile and arguably much more deeply interconnected. We're talking about the transition from wrenches to electronics and diagnostics.
Yeah, this is exactly where the modern automotive landscape shifts dramatically from traditional mechanical repair into basically advanced IT work.
It really is IT work now.
There is a vast canyon between generic OBD2 scanners and manufacturer-level module diagnostics. A generic scanner might give you a vague, standardized emission code, but it rarely, if ever, tells you the full diagnostic story.
It's like trying to diagnose a complex, multi-system human illness using nothing but a standard oral thermometer.
Exactly.
You know, the patient has a 102-degree fever, which means something is wrong. But is it a seasonal flu? A severe bacterial infection? A rare autoimmune response? The thermometer physically cannot give you that data. And a generic code reader is just an automotive thermometer.
I love that. To find the actual root cause of the digital illness, a professional diagnostic process has to answer four highly specific questions.
Okay, what are they?
First, what fault codes are stored across all of the vehicle's control modules, not just the primary engine computer?
Wait, I want to explore that first step a little more.
All right.
Checking fault codes across all modules. Why on earth would the stereo system or the climate control module care if the engine is experiencing a misfire? Like, how are those related?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, modern automotive repairs are holistic system repairs, not isolated single part repairs.
Okay.
The car's internal network relies on a continuous stream of shared data across miles of wiring. But more fundamentally than data, the entire network relies on absolutely stable electricity.
Oh, the battery.
Yes. In an environment like Dallas, batteries are placed under immense continuous stress from the heat. When a 12-volt battery gets weak, the baseline voltage of the entire electrical system drops.
I think I see where the dominoes are falling here.
Yeah, every single control module and sensor in that vehicle requires a very specific, highly stable voltage to operate accurately. If the battery is weak and the voltage drops, a perfectly healthy sensor might not get enough power to function.
So it just sends bad data.
Exactly. It sends skewed, inaccurate mathematical data to the central computer. Suddenly, your dashboard looks like a neon sign of cascading system failures.
Just lighting up.
You have transmission faults, dynamic stability control failures, steering warnings, but there is a brilliant, albeit highly complex, engineering reality behind it. As a lead-acid or AGM battery ages over years of heat and use, its internal chemical resistance naturally increases. It physically loses its capacity to hold a charge.
Okay, sure.
The car's power management computer constantly tracks the exact age, temperature, and degradation curve of that specific battery. Over time, it continuously commands the alternator to charge the battery harder, pushing higher voltage to overcome that increasing internal resistance.
Wait, I need to understand the physics of that. If you just drop a brand new low resistance battery into the car, but you don't tell the computer?
The computer continues operating on the assumption that it's still dealing with a 5-year-old highly degraded battery.
Oh.
Yeah, it will blast the brand new battery with a highly aggressive high voltage charging cycle meant to overcome massive internal resistance. Because the new battery has very low resistance, that aggressive charge will literally boil the electrolyte acid inside the battery casing.
You've got to be kidding.
Nope. It will permanently destroy a brand new component in a matter of months. That digital registration process is what resets the alternator's charging profile back to a gentle baseline.
That perfectly illustrates how hypersensitive and deeply interconnected the electrical and mechanical systems truly are. But, as we established with the Texas heat, these systems don't exist in a vacuum. A machine's lifespan is dictated almost entirely by the physical environment it's subjected to every single day.
Without a doubt.
And we could break this down into two very distinct driving profiles in the Dallas area.
Yeah, the contrast between the two is highly revealing. First, you have the highway and tollway commutes, sustained high-speed driving.
Right.
This environment places immense continuous thermal stress on the cooling system we talked about, but it also brutally exposes suspension and steering wear. High-speed impacts from potholes or expansion joints accelerate bushing wear, and this is heavily exacerbated by the run-flat tires many modern luxury cars use.
Oh, because run flats are so stiff.
Yeah, exactly. They have incredibly stiff, reinforced sidewalls. Instead of the tire absorbing the kinetic energy of a bump, that rigid sidewall transfers the impact force directly into the rubber suspension bushings, literally tearing them apart over time.
So if you are a highway commuter, you are constantly monitoring for slight steering wheel vibrations under heavy braking, a wandering feeling in the lane, or uneven tire wear.
Exactly.
But then we pivot to the absolute opposite extreme, short trip urban driving, neighborhoods where the car rarely goes over 40 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, these quick, low-speed trips are actually significantly harder on the physical machinery.
It completely defies conventional logic. Most people assume that if you only drive your car 2 miles to the grocery store and back, you're preserving the machine. You're keeping the mileage phenomenally low.
Right.
But mechanically and chemically, you're inducing a unique, severe set of stresses.
Wait, how does driving less cause more damage?
Well, when you only operate an engine for 5 or 10 minutes, a massive volume of cold metal is suddenly exposed to combustion heat. This creates rapid internal condensation.
Oh, water inside the engine.
Exactly. Normal, sustained driving heats the engine oil and the coolant well past the boiling point of water, safely evaporating that moisture out through the exhaust. But if you never reach full operating temperature, that condensation never burns off.
Where does it go?
It remains trapped. It mixes with the engine oil and the sulfur byproducts of combustion to create a highly corrosive, acidic sludge that eats away at internal bearings.
Gross. And from an electrical standpoint, the battery never gets a chance to fully recharge from the massive energy drain required by the starter motor to just turn the engine over.
You've got it. You are constantly draining the battery without giving the alternator the required highway time to replenish it. Plus, the stop-and-go nature of urban driving means the underhood temperatures spike rapidly at red lights, then cool down when you park a few minutes later.
Which is that exact heat cycling mechanism we discussed earlier that destroys rubber gaskets, plastics, and seals.
Bingo.
So your daily driving habit is the ultimate invisible variable. You could have two identical 528i models built on the exact same assembly line on the exact same day.
Same exact car.
And the one driven entirely on short neighborhood trips might have a chemically degraded battery, massive carbon buildup on the intake valves, and leaking oil seals. Meanwhile, the one commuting 60 miles a day on the tollway might have an incredibly healthy engine, but desperately needs a complete suspension overhaul.
Precisely. And this highlights a critical flaw in relying solely on the car's internal computer to tell you when maintenance is required.
Oh, right, the dashboard reminders.
Yeah, modern vehicles use calculation software, like BMW's condition-based service, or CBS. The software tracks your mileage, fuel consumption, and driving habits to calculate an estimated timeline for oil changes or brake pad replacements. But CBS is a mathematical model. It is completely blind to physical reality. It cannot see a microscopic coolant leak developing at a water pump fitting. It cannot feel an aging rubber suspension bushing tearing. It calculates. It does not observe.
Wow. So what does this all mean for the person holding the keys? I mean, we've covered a massive amount of technical ground today, from the fluid dynamics of variable valve timing and the carbon consequences of direct injection to migrating oil leaks and voltage drops that literally gaslight an entire computer network.
We covered a lot.
How do you decide if repairing a complex aging machine is actually a financially sound decision?
You know, it entirely comes down to context and documented history. A well-maintained vehicle with a clean interior, a strong, smoothly shifting transmission, a healthy, pressure-tested cooling system, and a comprehensive service history is absolutely worth the continued financial investment. You are maintaining a known quantity.
Okay, but what if you're looking at a heavily neglected vehicle, one that has multiple overlapping oil and coolant leaks? Maybe a documented history of overheating events that could have warped the block, worn suspension components, and a dashboard indicating cascading system failures.
Then you have to step back. You must demand absolute clarity from a diagnostic technician. You need them to objectively separate the legally or mechanically required work from the preventative recommended work so you understand exactly what the immediate mechanical threat is.
Right. Triage the situation.
Exactly. And stepping back to look at the broader landscape, this raises an important question about the future of transportation.
Oh.
Yeah. We've seen how modern vehicles require manufacturer-level module diagnostics just to interpret a physical symptom, and how they require highly specific software registration just to change a fundamental component like a 12-volt battery.
Right.
It forces us to ask, are we rapidly approaching an era where we no longer truly own our vehicles in a mechanical sense, but are instead simply subscribing to their proprietary software, their sensor networks, and their authorized diagnostic tools?
Wow. That is a fascinating, slightly unsettling thought to leave on. You purchase the metal, the glass, and the rubber, but without authorized access to the digital ecosystem that governs them, you essentially own a very heavy, highly complex paperweight in your driveway.
Pretty much.
Something to ponder the next time you push the start button and wait for the digital network to wake up. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll catch you next time.